In his first address before the United Nations General Assembly yesterday, President Trump said that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, or Rocket Man, as Trump called him, is on a suicide mission for his recent nuclear weapons tests, missile launches, and threats against the U.S. And Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea if America is forced to defend itself or its allies. So what do we think of this? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. We'll talk with our guest analyst about what Trump said and how he said it, and we'll look at the options the Trump administration may be considering toward North Korea and potential roles the global community may play. We'll also discuss why Trump has passed on opportunities to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement, despite his criticism for the deal before the UN yesterday. He called it embarrassing. Let's welcome our guest. Peter Feaver is a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. His areas of expertise include international relations, security, peace, and conflict. He was a national security official in the Bill Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, you know, let's just start with the comment that's getting the most headlines when President Trump was talking about North Korea and its nuclear weapons programs and threats. He had a stern warning for North Korea, particularly Kim Jong-un. Let's take a listen.
The United States has great strength and patience, but if it is forced to defend itself or its allies, we will have no choice but to totally destroy North Korea. Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself and for his regime.
All right, let's talk first about that nickname, Rocket Man. What was your reaction to that? And maybe more importantly, how does the world perceive that?
Well, as a former White House official, my immediate thought was that in the prepared remarks, or did the president deliver that extemporaneously? I suspect that might be one he wrote in on the margins, because it certainly is right in his voice, whereas a lot of the rest of the speech reads like it's been written by a speechwriter for the president, reflecting the president's vision, of course, but with a more poetic turn of phrase than the president tends to use when he's speaking off the cuff. So this was something straight from the president, and he actually foreshadowed it the day or two before when he tweeted out that nickname. So that was my first reaction. The second reaction was, this is a sauce for the goose and sauce for the gander. For the last 70 years, North Korean leaders have used all sorts of bombast and nicknames and really hyperbolic rhetoric in describing everybody that they dislike, while the West has responded with much more diplomatic language. For the first time, they've got a president who can dish it out as well as they can, and that's what the president is doing. I'm not sure that it's a game changer in terms of making diplomacy more effective, nor do I think it's a game changer in terms of leading us down an escalation spiral. I think it's just a change that draws attention. And you know, leads the story as it is the case today. This was not what the White House necessarily wanted you to be asking me about. They were trying to lay out a bigger vision, but you're asking me about Rocket Man.
Yeah, that's right. Because it is certainly different. We're not used to seeing the President of the United States kind of mock another world leader like that. And you're saying that's typical of other world leaders mocking us?
No, that's typical of North Korea's leaders mocking us, right? That's a staple of North Korea, and not just us. Every international opponent they have, their nightly newscast is full of this kind of bombast. So in that sense, it's giving back what they've been dishing out for a long, long time.
Yeah, you sent an email to my producer Bill Mertens yesterday after the speech, saying that it seemed like it might be better fit in a campaign environment than a government setting. Why do you say that?
Well, the Rocket Man quote, that certainly has the feel of some of the other nicknames that he's given, whether it's Crooked Hillary or Little Marco, or, you know, when he was belittling his political opponents or his, you know, people in the media that he didn't like, he would do that. And those were generally applause lines, or at least laugh lines, in his campaign stump speeches. And so he's borrowing a page from that. So there's that, a little bit of that mixed into what was otherwise meant to be a thoughtful speech evaluating the threats and opportunities facing the United States. Mm. But there's also a larger way in which it's the speech is something of a blend. The administration campaigned on a vision of America's role in the world that was quite narrow, quite transactional, and hasn't worked well. Was rejected by the foreign policy establishment and hasn't worked well. And what they've been doing is slowly evolving in the direction of a more traditional foreign policy, while also trying to blend their evolving policy into the rhetoric of the campaign. And this was the latest effort, I think. In fact, it's probably the most important effort to date of the administration trying to blend those two things. The president's worldview, which is very transactional, narrow, everybody's out for themselves in a dog-eat-dog fashion, with the demands of governance, which require cooperation, including cooperation under the auspices of multilateral institutions like the UN, which require a different kind of approach. And so they're trying to merge those two.
Yeah. As for the U.S. totally destroying North Korea if we're forced to defend ourselves or our allies, what do you suppose he's talking about there?
Well, that's not a change from previous administrations. You can find previous examples going back quite a ways, including President Bush, 43, who warned that the North Korean government would be held responsible if their nuclear material was distributed to anyone else, particularly to a terrorist, that then used it. We would hold North Korea responsible and respond accordingly, which would, it was understood, mean the destruction of the North Korean regime. This has been a fact of the North Korean situation for decades, that the U.S. can, U.S. and its allies, U.S. and South Korea and Japan, can and would prevail in a war against North Korea and would destroy North Korea, North Korean military, and the North Korean political regime in any conflict. The problem is that in the process of doing so, before they had accomplished that, North Korea would be able to extract a huge price, a huge blood price from South Korea because of North Korea's massive artillery, which is all within range of South Korea's capital. So we could have as many as a million South Koreans dead. Certainly tens of thousands, including many, many Americans, before the war was over. And that's North Korea's military strategy, is to make that price so high that the U.S. would not dare attack, even though the ultimate outcome would be the destruction of North Korea.
Yeah. Jerry on Facebook says, threatening nuclear war at the U.N., is this really the new normal?
Well, the U.S. Has said that we will consider it unacceptable for North Korea to have a nuclear arsenal, and that's been a position that previous administrations have held. It's not just President Trump. He's doubled down on that rhetoric, but he's in keeping with every post-Cold War president terms of viewing the acceptability of the North Korean arsenal. And every president has tried to get rid of those weapons diplomatically and failed. And every administration has developed war plans to deal with the problem if diplomacy proves ineffective. So I'm not sure that that's as big a change as your correspondent on Facebook is implying.
We're going to check news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll continue talking about President Trump's speech before the UN yesterday, where he threatened to totally destroy North Korea, where he called Kim Jong-un rocket man. We're wondering what you think, what questions you have, what options are before the United States when it comes to the nuclear threat from North Korea. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Joy Kerdine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Kerdine. We are analyzing President Trump's speech to the UN yesterday with our guest, Peter Feaver, a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. His areas of expertise include international relations, security, peace, and conflict. He was a national security official in both the George W. Bush administration and the Bill Clinton administration. We welcome your reactions and questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Kerdine Show Facebook page. So, Professor Feaver, when President Trump mentioned that totally destroying North Korea would be our only option if we're on the defensive, do you agree with that assessment, or are there alternatives?
Well, he didn't say that that was our first option. Their strategy is to raise the specter of a military confrontation so as to scare China into using its substantial leverage over North Korea to put pressure on North Korea to negotiate in good faith. So they're not pursuing the military option first. They're using the threat of military force in order to invigorate diplomacy. And that's pretty much the same strategy that previous administrations used. They differ from previous administrations in terms of the strategic communications element, how they talk about it, how they message on it, the you know, florid rhetoric. Those are slight differences. But in terms of the core diplomatic coercive diplomacy strategy, it's essentially what previous administrations tried. That's the good news. The bad news is previous administrations tried and failed.
Right.
So it's not necessarily a reason for optimism. The North Koreans have proven remarkably adamant in continuing their nuclear program in defiance of international pressure. And to date, we, the United States and our partners, have not been able to put enough pressure on North Korea to have them change that calculus.
Yeah. I mean, do you see anything that would make North Korea change that calculus?
Well, China is ratcheting up pressure on North Korea more now than they did in the last 5 years or so. And there's still financial levers available to the United States that would increase the pressure still greater. The time when North Korea howled the most, felt the most pain, was in the Bush administration, when the Bush administration used certain legal tools to seize funds that North Korea had in banks outside of North Korea in retaliation for North Korea counterfeiting U.S. currency. So North Korea had a counterfeiting scheme where they would print fake U.S. dollars, but the fakes were so good that most people took them for real. This was a gross violation of international law and U.S. law, and U.S. Used tools that Congress had given the executive branch to seize that money. and it was money in a bank called Banco Delta Asia. And the North Koreans were furious with this and very worried by it because, of course, their regime depends on their elite having access to monies like this. And that drove the North Koreans to the bargaining table in a way that they hadn't, they'd been resisting up until that point. The deal then collapsed, so the U.S. was unable to maintain that pressure to long enough to produce a diplomatic outcome. But that suggests a way of pressuring the North Koreans, and the U.S. has threatened to do something like that, again, going after banks and firms in China that do business with North Korea. That would ratchet up the pressure on North Korea substantially.
Yeah. Why doesn't the U.S. just live with a nuclear-capable North Korea?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a question that that is often asked in academic seminars. So it's a classic essay question for a midterm exam in an intro IR class, which doesn't mean it's a bad one. It means it's a good one. Here's the reason why no administration has been willing to embrace that as an option, even though you could argue we are defaulting to that by not taking military action. But first of all, North Korea has sold every military technology it's developed, including some of its nuclear weapons program. So it had links to the Syrian nuclear program that was destroyed in 2007. Then there were links to, from North Korea to that. So living with a North Korean nuclear weapon is living with North Korea sharing its nuclear know-how with other rogue regimes. Secondly, it means living with the proliferation pressure that would put on South Korea, Japan, and probably Taiwan to follow suit. Why should North Korea be allowed to have nuclear weapons and not Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan? That, of course, is something that the Chinese have said is utterly unacceptable to them, that South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan would have nuclear weapons. And so you would be, quote-unquote, living with a nuclear arms race in Northeast Asia. And it's hard to see that world as preferable to the world with North Korea not having nuclear weapons. So that's why every administration, including all regional players, would prefer that North Korea give up its nuclear program.
Well, let's take a call. We have an open line for you if you have a reaction to President Trump's remarks before the UN yesterday, where he was addressing North Korea. We'll also, in a bit, talk about what he had to say about the U.S. nuclear deal with Iran. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bill in River Falls is with us. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. A question again on North Korea. Why would the seemingly similar approach of regional pressure, diplomatic pressure, work with Iran and at least bring Iran to the table to get into this nuclear deal and not Korea? It seems like, you know, I mean, that's probably a whole term paper, but, you know, if it worked on one group, Iran responded, whether it's truly the worst deal ever from a president who's probably never read it. I know I haven't, but, I mean, it seems like the approach worked with Iran, but not with North Korea. If you had any comments on that, I'd like to hear them. Thank you.
Professor Fever?
So the financial pressure that the Bush administration and then the Obama administration following and expanding on Bush's strategy that they mounted against Iran is greater than the financial pressure that has thus far been mounted against North Korea. So another way to say, describe President Trump's strategy on North Korea is he's seeking to impose on North Korea a level of financial pressure that's commensurate with the level that the world imposed on Iran. That's the first point. The second point is that North Korea has an escape hatch with China China, which is effectively props up North Korea economically and provides something of a heat shield for North Korea when it faces extreme pressure from the outside. That's a heat shield that Iran lacked. So China and Russia, China wasn't much involved in the Iranian issue, and Russia was more willing to put pressure on Iran than they were on North Korea. So there's complicated reasons for it. Partly it was that keeping Iranian energy off the market propped up prices, which helped the Russian economy, which is heavily dependent on export of energy. And so there was a sort of a unrelated selfish interest that Russia had to go along with the pressure. But they also were opposed to the idea of Iran having a nuclear weapon. So as the question also suggests, just getting them to the table is not a guarantee that you'll get a good deal. You can get them to the table, but then you have to be able to maintain that pressure and negotiate a good deal. And the Trump critique of the Obama administration is that they fumbled the ball. At the end, they ended up accepting a deal, and they just got out-negotiated by the Iranians.
Yeah, we'll take a listen to his comments. He criticized Iran for destabilizing the Middle East, and he hinted that America's days in the Iran nuclear deal may be coming to an end. Let's hear that.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into. Frankly, that deal is an embarrassment to the United States, and I don't think you've heard the last of it, believe me.
Well, first, why does President Trump think it's an embarrassment?
Well, yeah, it's quite a hyperbolic critique. There were lots of responsible critics at the time, so in the 2000. Well, in the run-up to the negotiations and then when the deal was announced and debated in Congress, a lot of responsible critics pointed out some deficiencies in the deal. It's time-limited, so it really just delays the Iranian nuclear program. It doesn't end the Iranian nuclear program. It left off the table all sorts of non-nuclear activities, and at the very end, the Obama administration, in a last-ditch concession, even made a concession on missiles, which it had promised it wouldn't make, basically accepting an Iranian talking point on their missile program that the U.S. had rejected and promised that they would never acknowledge. But they did that at the last minute and did not address any of the rest of Iran's nefarious activities. Now, the administration said quite clearly, this is just a nuclear deal, and we will address all of Iran's other activities in other settings. However, in order to preserve the deal and try to build diplomatic momentum, the Obama administration, after it signed the JCPOA, was reluctant to put much pressure on Iran. So, in effect, Iran got more of a free pass on these other nefarious activities that were not covered by the deal. And I think those were are points that many responsible critics, including some who were from inside the Obama administration, who thought that the administration should not have made the last-minute concessions it did make. And President Trump is just delivering those critiques with a lot of hyperbole around it.
In March of 2016, in a speech to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, then-candidate Trump said his top priority was to dismantle the disastrous deal with Iran. He had some opportunities to back out of this deal during his presidency so far, including as recently as last week when he actually extended sanctions relief to Iran. Iran supposedly is following the terms of the deal. So why hasn't Trump gotten out of the agreement yet?
One of the criticisms of the deal is that it front-loaded all the benefits for Iran. And so Iran gets access to frozen assets and gets sanctions relief up front, and the benefits to the United States become greater over time. So in year 7, year 8, year 9, there's less in the deal for Iran than there is for the United States. That's a criticism Trump administration made, and it's true. And the irony is, because of that, it's actually more in U.S. interest to keep the deal today than it was when the deal was first announced, because we've already made all of our concessions, and we're starting to get whatever residual benefits there are. We get more and more of them the longer the deal goes in. So that's the first thing that's trapped the administration. The second is that the only reason we got a deal this good, even if you say it's not good enough, the only reason we got it this good is because of the financial pressure that Iran was under. And you cannot reassemble that financial pressure without getting the rest of the world, that would be Russia and our European allies, on board putting that pressure on, and they have been adamant that they won't do that. So it would be the U.S. walking away with almost no pressure on Iran, and with our allies viewing us as the problem rather than Iran. And so that's a second reason why it's hard for the U.S. to walk away. And then the third reason is that from the narrow terms of the deal, precisely because the deal left out all of the rest of Iran's nefarious activities, it's possible, indeed, are the intelligence community and the IAEA has said Iran is actually in technical compliance with the deal. Yes, they're doing all these other bad things, but those bad things are not covered by the deal. So the compromise the Trump administration settled on, which is, I think, probably the right one, is to continue to honor the nuclear deal because narrowly Iran is in compliance with that. Of course, insist that it be monitored very closely so that and verified in case Iran is cheating, but separately punish Iran for separate activities quite independent of the nuclear deal, and make it clear that these other sanctions are for Iran's other nefarious activities, and we are continuing to honor the nuclear deal. That's the compromise the administration has struck for the last 9 months, and I think it's probably the right one.
Yeah. So on Monday, though, Trump said that he's very close to making a decision on whether to kill the deal. He said that the U.S. needs to either fix the deal or scrap it altogether. Do you have any sense as to what Trump's going to do?
Well, President Trump has said he really doesn't like this compromise that I described before. He thinks it's weak, and it leaves in place a deal that he has criticized sharply. So he's very keen to find another way out. And that's what he keeps hinting at. That's what he hinted at in the speech. The problem is that no one has been able to identify a way out that would put the U.S. in a better position than the compromise that I outlined. So at some point you ask yourself, are you willing to cut off your nose to spite your face? Are you willing to jettison this deal just because you're so angry and you want to prove that it was a bad deal, but in the process leave the United States even more exposed because Iran would be freed up from even more pressure and would then, by the terms of the deal, be free to pursue a nuclear program on an accelerated basis? So I think that's why even sharp critics of the deal in the Republican Party came to the conclusion we're stuck. We have to honor it. That's part of the problem with the Obama's deal, is that he tied the hands of the United States in this way.
We're talking with Peter Feaver, a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. He was a national security official in the Bill Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for him about what President Trump had to say yesterday before the United Nations. 1-800-642-1234. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. We are breaking down President Donald Trump's address before the UN yesterday, in which he said North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, or Rocket Man as he called him, was on a suicide mission for his recent nuclear weapons tests and launches and threats. We are looking at the options the Trump administration may be considering toward North Korea. We are discussing other things that President Trump had to say, including why he has passed on opportunities to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement, despite his criticism of it. And we're welcoming your questions and your reactions, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest was a national security official in the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. He is Peter Fever, a professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. Let's go back to the phones. Bernie in Elkhorn is with us. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, good morning. Trump's belligerent threats and rhetoric are really disgraceful, but he just kind of makes evident, you know, what is often a more hidden and dark U.S. foreign policy. I'd reference Paul Craig Roberts, who was in the Reagan administration, who wanted Trump to be elected, but it was written extensively how neither North Korea nor Iran are a threat to the United States or anybody else. Basically, the United States overthrew the government of Iran twice, I believe, Mossadegh in the 50s. The Stuxnet virus was used against Iran under Obama for cyber attack. North Korea was basically leveled during the Korean War that the U.S. instigated. Millions were killed. The buildings were completely leveled. There's no historical memory amongst the American people. Bush put North Korea on the axis of evil. They're scared to death. The U.S. has a history of invading governments like Iraq, et cetera. We have drone wars going on in many countries right now. There's not a country on earth that does as much murder and mayhem as our own government does.
Let me get our guest to respond to that. Those other countries are scared to death of the U.S. Professor Fever?
Well, I just disagree with the caller that there's no country on earth that does more murder and mayhem than the United States. I think that there's a rogues gallery of regimes that have done far, far worse than the United States. And that kind of sloppy moral equivalence it has been rejected by Republican and Democratic administrations throughout the Cold War. Now, that is not to say that that everything that the U.S. Tries has worked well. And so there certainly is a long record of frustration when it comes to dealing with regimes like Iran or North Korea, but it's just it's just fatuous to suggest that the United States treats others the way North Korea treats its own citizens and treats others.
That's that being said, are North Korea and Iran afraid of the United States?
That's a different question, and yes, they are afraid of the United States, and they're afraid of that the United States will do regime change. And here, the historical record gives them some reason for believing that. The U.S. did depose Saddam Hussein, who was seeking nuclear weapons but didn't have it, did depose Gaddafi, who actually was seeking nuclear weapons, then abandoned his effort, and then was attacked. Whereas the United States has not deposed a leader that possesses a nuclear arsenal. So one of the reasons why Iran has an interest in developing nuclear weapons and why North Korea is insistent on keeping theirs is they view it as a guarantee for regime survival.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mark in Waukesha now. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just a quick comment. Do I believe that North Korea has to be dealt with a firm hand? Absolutely. I think the guy is a bully. But I just, when the president is talking to the UN and the world is basically the audience listening in, I would expect something dealt with a little bit better than barroom talk. It doesn't do anything for our country's standing. And I think one of the things we always have to remember is Donald Trump got elected in by the angry white males. So this macho talk is still kind of what, I guess, Trump believes America wants to hear. In my mind, I believe it's the dumbing down of America.
All right. Reaction, Professor Fever?
Well, I have some sympathy for what he's saying, because I'm quite confident that the caller did not read the entire speech. And if he had, he would have seen that the lines that you and I have been talking about are about two or three of a speech that prints out at 15 pages or something like that. And the rest of it is a thoughtful, somewhat tortuous, somewhat, you know, confused investigation of concepts of sovereignty and multilateral cooperation among sovereign nations. And the administration did itself no favors by, because I think they wanted people to talk about those and reflect on those aspects, but instead we're going after a couple lines that are bombastic and newsworthy, tweetworthy, and this has been a persistent pattern for the administration. They'll have a more sophisticated strategy they're trying to pursue, and then a tweet will come, and all of the attention chases the tweet.
Right.
And you have to say that's their own fault, right? They are control what comes out of the administration, and so in a sense they're setting the agenda and tripping themselves up in the process.
Right. And while, yes, we have been certainly talking about Rocket Man and totally destroying North Korea as a part of that speech, and we will talk about a couple other things before we're done here. How does
I'm not criticizing you.
No. How does the world though? That all the other UN delegations sitting there, even if it was just a line or two, react to the president? How did the world react to the president calling North Korea's leader the Rocket Man?
Well, there probably were some eye rolls. And yet, by now, the international community has adjusted to the president's diplomatic style. They read the tweets as closely as anyone else, and they have learned to not overreact to the tweets. But that doesn't mean that they like them.
Yeah, let's go to Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary. Mary? I guess, Mary, let me put it this way. There's so many countries, but I guess she is saying, are there countries who were not supportive of what Trump said? And maybe who supported what Trump said and who didn't support it, as in the key players?
Right. So China is concerned about the rhetoric, as is Russia. And so one of the challenges for the administration is how to get Russia and China to ratchet up pressure on North Korea, not be the escape valve. So Russian firms are evading the sanctions. Chinese firms are evading the sanctions. We need the Chinese and Russian governments fully enforcing the existing sanctions and supporting a higher level of pressure. How do you get them to do that? The Trump approach is to scare them into doing that, thinking that if they don't, the alternative is the U.S. is actually going to go to war. And that's a reasonable strategy to pursue, but it's a high risk one, and you want to scare them into cooperating, but not scare them so much that they take alternative actions to thwart the United States. And so it's a difficult needle to thread. But the immediate reaction out of China and Russia was lukewarm on the North Korea section.
Trump also used the speech to reaffirm his America First doctrine. He urged the rest of the world to look at, he said the rest of the world should be looking out for themselves as well. Let's take a listen.
As President of the United States, I will always put America first. Just like you, as the leaders of your countries, will always and should always put your countries first.
So what does that tell us, Professor Fever?
Well, it's either banal or misleading. So at one level, of course, it's true. Every state puts its interests first, but that's also then true of all of his predecessors, right? So at that level, it's a banal observation. If you're suggesting that it's a big change to put American interests first, then what you must mean is that you are defining those interests in very narrow, short-term, transactional senses that misses the longer-term and what might be called the enlightened self-interest. And so that's where critics of the president's rhetoric, including myself, who's written on this, said that the president's missing a point that previous leaders understood, which is it's in our longer-term interests to shoulder a disproportionate burden now in order to prop up an international order that's been so good for U.S. interests. And if you view everything as a narrow transaction, who got the most out of this petty deal or that petty deal, you miss the bigger picture. Yeah. And so you're either banal when you say everyone's doing what's in their interests, or you're redefining interests very narrowly in a way that is unhelpful for the long term.
Yeah. So we just have about a minute or so to go. I mean, was there something else about the speech yesterday that you think is something we should note?
Well, you should note that despite all that rhetoric about only looking at sovereignty and encouraging other states to have their free, independent sovereignty, the administration or the president went on to criticize a number of countries for what they did within their borders. Basically, the president discovered his inner neoconservative who criticized Cuba and Venezuela and Iran and other states for their violation of human rights at home. Well, that's precisely been a staple of American foreign policy for decades. President Trump candidate Trump campaigned against that kind of language, but now he's back delivering it at the UN, and I think that's newsworthy and noteworthy.
Yeah. So I guess so. What's next?
Well, the president's going to unveil his national security strategy, and this was a preview of that strategy. And there, they're going to answer more of the kinds of questions that critics have raised about how you square the circle between short-term and long-term interests and sovereign states and human rights, and look for that to come out in the next couple weeks or months and answer, hopefully, some of these questions.
Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Peter Fever, professor of political science and public policy at Duke University. He was a national security official in the George W. Bush administration and also in Bill Clinton's administration. Thank you to Bill Martins and to Nyasia Ellison for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.